You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or archive shows, visit kevinfulham.net. Welcome to another edition of Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Scott Von Doviak, who is a culture critic. He is a contributor to the AV Club and Nerve.com. He is also the author of a new book called If You Like the Terminator. Here are 200 movies, TV shows, and other oddities that you will also love. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Kevin.
Yeah, so the book is really looking at the film The Terminator. We're coming on almost 30 years. It came out back in 1984 with Schwarzenegger as the title villain, and really putting him on the map with regards to his box office success. Why is The Terminator such a pivotal film? You kind of have it at the nexus of a lot of different sorts of genres, you know, regarding artificial intelligence, science fiction, dystopia. Why is The Terminator really at the center of all that?
Well, that's actually why I wanted to use The Terminator for this book. There were several other options, but it seemed to me that The Terminator was kind of a, you know, genre mashup before they really had a term for that, where director James Cameron was sort of taking all these different elements of science fiction, post-apocalyptic future, the idea of time travel, you know, robots and evil computers, and, you know, sort of putting them all together in this 80s action movie and sort of, in the process of doing that, creating an 80s action icon in Schwarzenegger, who had not, you know, been used in a role like this. He had been seen basically in your sword and sandals kind of movies like Conan and Hercules. So it was a first for him, kind of a first for Cameron, and one of the seeds of what's been called and what I write about in the book as tech-noir, which is kind of a melding of styles of film noir and science fiction. So it was a great jumping-off point for all those reasons.
It's pretty interesting. You talk about, you know, Cameron's background. He worked for Roger Corman, a master of the B movie, the B science fiction movie, and how he had to do everything on a bare bones budget. Also, how apparently he didn't want Schwarzenegger for the film.
Well, he wasn't his first choice. He had some ideas in mind. People who actually did make it into the film in other roles, like Michael Dean and Lance Henriksen. One idea that was put forth, I guess, by the studio was the idea of casting O.J. Simpson as the Terminator. Cameron vetoed that on the grounds that he couldn't picture O.J. as a killer. So I think that probably shows the limits of his imagination, but I think it's probably for the best that O.J. Simpson did not play the Terminator.
I think computers are fascinating to examine as villains. Computers and robots, certainly Arnold Schwarzenegger playing a cybernetic organism, I guess, in the movie it's called, you know, a robot with human skin. It seems that when you first had computers, you know, or we first had robots in society, that they're great sources of fear and mystery, and no one really knew what they could do. And then as time progresses, where more and more people have computers, you mentioned that when The Terminator came out, I think 8% of America had personal computers back in 1984. And as time progresses, maybe there's, you know, people are more familiar with technology. Do you see a change in the depiction of computers and robots over time?
Oh, absolutely. You know, early on, in earlier science fiction movies, we didn't have computers in real life. They were just things we saw in science fiction movies. I mean, I remember growing up as a very small child watching episodes of Star Trek, and, you know, a computer was something that filled an entire room. And so there was a certain awe-inspiring quality to them. And we certainly didn't have them in our homes, and people didn't know what they could do. And I think probably very early on, the fear of computers and robots was maybe a sort of fear of automation, of people losing their jobs to, you know, sort of machines. I think the first computer as we would know it in a movie was, strangely enough, a Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy romantic comedy called The Desk Set, which I've never actually seen, but it's apparently based on that very idea. You know, a guy comes in with a computer that's gonna take over people's jobs and their fear of that. And then as time progressed, you got more into, you know, into the 50s and early 60s. It became, I think, more associated with a Cold War fear. You know, the Soviet Union had put Sputnik, the first satellite, into orbit, and we didn't know what was going on over there. They could have had any kind of scary computer for world domination, you know, which is an idea that sort of feeds into Dr. Strangelove and the idea of the Doomsday Device.
What were some of the other iconic films that came out during that time period that were centered around computers and robots?
Well, earliest example, I guess, of a robot in film, or at least certainly of a human-looking robot, there had been, I guess, short films about mechanical men. The word robot itself wasn't even coined until the 1920s. And in the 1920s, Fritz Lang made Metropolis, which was, you know, a silent science fiction film, one of the biggest films made to that point. Fritz Lang came out of German Expressionism, and he sort of envisioned this futuristic world just based on what he had seen of New York and the buildings, and he sort of took that to this dystopian level that has been paid homage to or ripped off many times since. But that movie sort of takes place in a society where the very wealthy are exploiting the underclass, who are keeping the machines running, the machines that power society, and that's kind of kept vague. And that's what you find as you go back in time in films. The less we knew about computers at the time, the less is actually revealed in the films. But there is a scientist in the film who builds a robot, and it's a robot duplicate of a human woman. It sort of uses this robot to sow dissension, and it's actually, the story itself is a little on the naive side, but just visually, it was a real breakthrough for science fiction and also for some of the ideas in it, notably, you know, the idea of robots and of a mechanized sort of society.
Well, in your book, you talk about how, you know, the whole motif of the robot, you're talking, I mean, it has its origins in the Frankenstein story, you know, even though, you know, Frankenstein is quote-unquote given life by his creator, but he's put together sort of like a machine.
Right. You know, he's an artificial life form of a sort. He's made out of human parts, but he is brought to life through science. That, I think, qualifies it as science fiction, even though it's also, of course, a horror movie. Also a great influence on the Terminator, of course, just the physicality of the Frankenstein monster, very similar to Arnold Schwarzenegger, especially throughout the course of the Terminator movie. He's deteriorating, he's getting into these accidents and starting to fall apart, his face is decaying and his eyeballs coming out and stuff, and he just looks more and more like this creature. And also he has very few lines of dialogue, which is one of the reasons why this probably ranks highest in the Schwarzenegger oeuvre performances. He doesn't have to say a lot, but he makes all the lines count.
I think you said he's got 16 lines of dialogue in the whole film.
That's correct, yes.
Then we go to a film, the iconic film 2001, A Space Odyssey. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think, you know, if you think of a computer in a movie as a villain in particular, HAL 9000 would always be the first one to spring to mind. In fact, I don't know how many other computers as characters you would even think of in films, because HAL is really the first one and one of the only ones that has a personality of his own. In fact, it's, you know, much remarked upon that HAL, the computer, has more personality than most of the human characters in 2001. His orders have sort of contradicted themselves. You know, he's been given two contradictory sets of orders, and as a computer, he can't process that. So he's not a villain in that he's trying to do wrong, but he's a villain in that he's a binary thinking machine that can't process the information correctly, and he ends up being a villain for that reason. So he's sympathetic for that reason, and also just because of the performance. It's the voice of Douglas Rain, and it's just a sort of strangely lulling voice for a computer that, you know, you would probably want to have if you had a long deep space mission. You would want the computer to have soothing tones. So it's really a brilliant creation, and I'm the definitive, you know, computer villain, I would say.
And received mixed reviews when it came out, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, there was a mixed reception when it first came out. I mean, sort of the New York critics didn't really, they called it pretentious and all that. But it happened to hit at a point when the counterculture was really revving up. And so young people in particular really embraced it. You know, it was a head trip kind of movie. Get high and watch it and have long dorm room bantering sessions afterward and that sort of thing. And it just has stuck around. I think, you know, at this point, certainly its reputation is much, much stronger than it was on initial release.
That came out, I believe it was around, I think it was 1968.
Yes.
A couple years later, you have a movie called Colossus, the Forbin Project. Not nearly as much of a success. You mentioned it in your book.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, I'm a fan of this film. Not many people have seen it at all. But I think it does a great job of capturing not only the like Cold War paranoia, but also the paranoia of artificial intelligence becoming sentient and becoming this sort of worldwide dictator in a sense. And Colossus, basically you have these two supercomputers in charge of both the American and the Soviet nuclear arsenals. And they become not only sentient, but wise to each other, and they communicate with each other and wind up holding the countries and essentially the world hostage. And a very, very dark film. It's not a film that has a very, a bright, happy ending. What are your thoughts on Colossus?
Well, I think you summed it up pretty nicely. I mean, it's sort of a forgotten film. What I was talking about earlier with the Cold War sort of paranoia, this certainly plays into it, where we don't know what they're doing, they don't know what we're doing, but as it turned out, they were both doing the same thing. They were both building these supercomputers that would ensure their domination over the rival superpower, not realizing that those two computers would become a greater superpower than either of them. But it also has this, there's some humor to it. It's kind of a, there's a whole aspect of sort of late 60s, early 70s style, and also just sort of the idea of this sort of this bureaucracy angle to it that's pretty amusing. But yeah, it does get very dark at the end.
Well, I think it's also interesting because, you know, that was a huge fear at that particular time. And certainly with Terminator, you know, you have, okay, Skynet becomes self-aware and is going to start a nuclear war and eliminate humanity. I think now, today, at least I find myself reading more and more about the direction of where computing is going, that, hey, maybe you might actually have computers that are able to perform so many calculations per second that they might as well be intelligent, and that, you know, perhaps it actually is a fear that we should be worried about in terms of, some sort of supercomputer threat down the line.
Yeah, well, I think, again, you know, we have, or at least we think we do, we understand computers a lot more now than we did then. We have them. And in a way, it's sort of more subtle way of the computers have taken over. They have enslaved us, but it's just that now they're handheld. And, you know, you can't walk down the street without bumping into six or seven people staring into them. And, you know, we're all sort of spending half our lives on the Internet. I'm not exempting myself from any of this, by the way. I use the same thing. But, yeah, I think, as more intelligent computers get, there's still great potential for them as villains. I mean, if you look into things like high-frequency trading on the stock market, it's pretty terrifying that, you know, computers can be making so many calculations per second, and we don't really know what they're doing. So I think the potential is still there for computers as villain characters in film.
I'm talking to Scott Von Duviak, who is the author of If You Like the Terminator, and it is a book that uses the Terminator as sort of as the hub of looking at films involving dystopia, artificial intelligence. You mentioned Tech Noir, which is actually the name of a club that was featured in the Terminator film that's sort of become its own little genre of movie. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that genre involves?
Well, film noir was a movement of post-war 40s era, darker films, lots of shadows, lots of flawed anti-heroes and things going awry. And the idea of merging that with science fiction is not actually new. There's a Jean-Luc Godard film called Alphaville, which is, I would say, pretty much the first tech noir. It's done in the style of a film noir with a detective character with a fedora and a trench coat and all those usual trappings of the noir genre. But it's set in a futuristic society, computer-run society. And, of course, probably the most famous tech noir, or the one that really kicked it off, was Blade Runner, which, again, has sort of the film noir trappings of an urban, blighted urban environment, cynical protagonist, detective with a trench coat. Some cuts of it have a world-weary voiceover narration, others don't, but there's all those elements of the film noir mixed in with this sort of dazzling futuristic society. And so that's the idea of tech noir.
You mentioned Blade Runner, and Blade Runner coming out, I believe, a couple years before the Terminator, 1982. Some similarities with regards to the fact that you have someone who's hunting down renegade androids, renegade robots,
right.
And with those robots being played by Rutger Hauer, and also Daryl Hannah is another one. How do you compare the two films as far as cultural impact with regards to, you know, science fiction cinema and so forth?
Well, I think they've both had an impact, but for Blade Runner, it's more visual. I don't think there are a lot of movies with the sort of tone of Blade Runner, the sort of, there's kind of a dreamy pace to it. It's an immersive sort of film that you sort of get sucked into the world of it, but it's not a fast-paced action movie, which is what The Terminator is. I mean, The Terminator is just this kinetic movie that keeps moving. Every bit of exposition that's delivered in it happens, you know, during a car chase. And that, I would say, has had more of an influence on movies of today, but, you know, more so than the original Terminator. Terminator 2 is the true influential one, you know, because it's so much more gargantuan, and also because it's the first real CGI movie. I mean, CGI had been used before. Cameron had used it before in The Abyss, briefly. But it really, when Terminator 2 came out, people were amazed at what could be done now with computers, and of course, a couple years later, Jurassic Park. And that whole direction has really influenced the course of science fiction. I wouldn't say for the better necessarily, but...
Well, yeah, Terminator 2, I believe at the time it was the most expensive movie ever made, around $100 million.
Yeah, pretty much every James Cameron movie since then has been the most expensive movie ever made, since the last one he made. So, yeah.
Going back to T2, and you mentioned the CGI that they used for the T-1000, the shape-shifting Terminator, that was very revolutionary at the time. Although, you know, like you said, they did some of that with his earlier film, The Abyss. What do you think of the modern action movie as descendants of T2, with the fact that, you know, you've got bigger and bigger budgets? You mentioned Michael Bay in your book, and not in a very positive light with regards to films like The Transformers. You also have global audiences that we're making movies for, which, you know, for those kinds of audiences, less dialogue is better and more explosions is better.
Well, there's definitely an irony in the case of Cameron in particular, because, you know, the whole idea of the first Terminator, which was made, you know, on a low budget and in accordance with what he had learned from Roger Corman. I mean, all the effects were handmade and, you know, all that. And, you know, the movie presented this sort of technophobic message that we should, you know, be wary of letting the machines encroach and take over. But really, that's what's happened to all this movie since then. I mean, on a bigger and bigger scale, you know, to the point where now he's only making Avatar movies, and they're almost entirely these digital creations made entirely by machines. So as his career has gone, so has gone, you know, the rest of mainstream action / science fiction filmmaking. And for some of the reasons you mentioned, I mean, you know, it's for global audiences, stories are a little less complex. You know, there's a huge committee of suits, and they bring in different writers. Every actor has to be a name recognized around the world, and he's going to bring in his own writer, and that's going to dilute whatever project it is further. So there are just so many factors. It's so hard to get a, you know, a really well-made, intelligent, and still fun blockbuster. You see them even more rarely, you know, for all these reasons.
I think it's funny you mentioned in the book that I think every company that's had a Terminator rights has gone bankrupt at some point.
Yes, there is something of a Terminator curse, I guess. Yeah.
And so we had the three movies with Schwarzenegger. We also recently had the Terminator, oh boy, what was the recent one with Christian Bale?
That was Terminator Salvation.
Terminator Salvation. But we also have a Terminator series on Fox. You know, you talk about Terminator movies getting, with regards to the action sort of genre, you have these, you know, bigger and bigger movies with bloated budgets. What did you think about the idea of a Terminator concept ported to television?
I enjoyed the TV series more than I expected. But the problem with the continued exploitation of the Terminator concept is that there's just not that much to it. You know, you have this sort of set, finite timeline, and once you start sending more and more robots, Terminators, and people back through time, it just gets really messy. You know, it's not like something like Star Trek where you can just go anywhere within the Star Trek universe and have a whole new series about a whole different bunch of characters. You know, Terminator always keeps coming back to these same characters. So the Terminator TV series has Sarah Connor as sort of the protagonist, and John Connor is a sullen teenager. And they have another Terminator comes back in time and sort of befriends them and helps them against the evil Terminators that keep getting sent back. But, so given the fact that the concept is kind of limiting, they still managed to do you know, they did some good, nice character work in it, and there were some nice, twisty episodes. It probably ran about as long as it should have, but it's worth a look.
Well, that was my original criticism with every movie beyond the first. So, you know, if they could, you know, the whole idea was brilliant that they could only send one Terminator and one human back. You know, but it turns out they sent multiple Terminators, so why couldn't they all send them to the same point in time? You know, if they could send three, they could send 300. You know, did this make any sense to you?
These are the thoughts I was having as I was writing the book and watching all these things. I was like, yeah, of course, that's what you would do. You would send 500 Terminators at the same point in time, and there'd be no chance. But, you know, then there's no story, so you have to accept these things, I guess.
I want to switch gears, actually, a little bit and talk about our views of the future. And certainly with Terminator, you have sort of this dystopian post-nuclear apocalyptic future where the computers have taken over and the humans are sort of scrounging through the rubble trying to survive and wage this war. And it's also sort of the whole look at dystopian future in cinema is another subject that you covered in your book. And what were some of the, I guess, the more notable films to look at those kinds of scenarios? I mean, you mentioned The Road Warrior, which is, you know, one of my favorite movies, an iconic movie looking at the post-apocalyptic outback.
Yeah, Road Warrior is definitely, I'd say, the best of them and also the most influential. I mean, there are just, now every vision of the future sort of looks like The Road Warrior, except not as cool. For me writing the book, I got to go back, you know, I'm sort of a child of the 70s and 80s, so I got to go back to some of the movies I loved as a kid and revisit them. Some of them, you know, hold up better than others. You know, one is... one that doesn't hold up great is Logan's Run, which is sort of a post-nuclear war scenario where a domed city has been built to protect people against the nuclear radiation outside, but to keep the population down, everyone has to die by the age of 30. And you know, the story, the first half is sort of interesting in exploring that world, but then the two young people escape, and it just kind of fizzles out from there.
I'm actually surprised that movie hasn't been remade since the original... Was full flawed, yeah.
Yeah, there's been a remake of that in the works for years. That's one of those development hell movies where, you know, different people have been attached. I think last people who were attached to it may still be our, I don't even know how to say this guy's name, but it's the guy who directed Drive and Ryan Gosling, like reuniting for Logan's Run. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but.
I think there's another movie that sort of takes a look at the near future, not as dim as Logan's Run, but or something like The Road Warrior, but RoboCop, which comes out just a few years after The Terminator in 1987. And with RoboCop, you have sort of this, it's focused on a decaying Detroit, and you still have authority, although the government's sort of in a bit of shambles. You have super powerful corporations, and... what are your thoughts on the sort of the influence that RoboCop had on dystopian cinema?
Well, I think, you know, the ones since RoboCop that have had sort of a satirical edge to them certainly owe a debt to it, because, you know, that movie had sort of these parody commercials and government / huge corporation conglomerate that we've seen a lot since then. And, you know, it was a tongue-in-cheek movie, but it also, you know, had... certainly brought some hardcore violence along with it, but that's one of my favorite post-Terminator ones. Another one that's less known than that is The Hidden. It's a similar structure to The Terminator, except instead of a cyborg from the future, it's an alien, and he can take human form, but he doesn't really have a plan. He just wants to have fun and use up these human bodies as quickly as he can, and, you know, drive fast cars, listen to loud music, have lots of sex. So it's it's this real consumerist 80s culture satire. It's got Kyle MacLachlan as his rival, the cop alien, who we don't, you know, find that out for a while, but it seems pretty obvious. He's posing as an FBI agent, so it's for fans of Twin Peaks, you should definitely check it out, because it's definitely the precursor to, you know, Agent Dale Cooper on that show.
I think it's also interesting if you look at, you know, getting back to RoboCop, just this notion that multinational corporations and big business, they function in a way like computers in terms of the fact that they're largely these faceless entities, they're sociopaths, and, you know, they have their sort of directives, and, you know, emotion does not enter into the equation. What do you think about that?
I think rather than have the computer be the ultimate villain, you know, now that we know more about how computers work, obviously computers in the hands of people like that, sort of remorseless capitalists, is an even more frightening thought.
You have also a movie like Aliens, another James Cameron movie, which we haven't mentioned before.
Right.
Certainly one of the iconic action movies of the 80s, a sequel to Alien, but really done more as an action movie instead of a horror film. And you have the Paul Reiser character, who is the representative of the corporation trying to capture the aliens and selling, you know, the rest of his crew out because there's a high monetary figure attached to the whole project.
A great weaselly performance by Paul Reiser in that role. Yeah, I think it's probably the case that since most of the movie studios are run by corporations just like that, that they probably try to shy away from those plot devices, corporations as huge villains, but they do sneak in once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you did have the remake of Manchurian Candidate. Instead of the Cold War, you had Manchurian Corporation. You know, they were the enemies. And
right.
I think also, too, in a lot of sci-fi stories, you know, they sort of predict, like, you know, the fall of governments and the rise of corporations. I'm thinking of Rollerball also as well, another one from the 70s.
Right.
Where you had Energy Corp and Food Corp and all those different conglomerates. Where do you see cinema right now with regards to views of the future? You know, we always say, well, we depict the future based on what the fears of the present are. And so when the Terminator came out, fear was nuclear war. And that was a long-running fear, you know, all the way back since the post-World War II environment. What do you see right now with regards to any sorts of trends regarding cinema that looks at the future?
Well, for a while there was a brief run of movies that were influenced by Philip K. Dick, who was a science fiction writer, a great paranoid character, and his works were all sort of infused with this paranoia of society and also questions of identity. And a lot of these sort of inward-looking science fiction movies were coming out for a while. The ones scripted by Charlie Kaufman, like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and Being John Malkovich, and also straight adaptations of Philip K. Dick's works, like Richard Linklater did A Scanner Darkly. For a while there, that seemed to be the trend of sort of, you know, looking inward, sci-fi terrors of the mind. But as far as, you know, what people see as threats in science fiction movies today, I'm not really sure about that. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of them don't have a lot on their mind anymore, the sci-fi movies, you know, the ones we've seen recently. I mean, something like Prometheus just seems to be going back to the well of the alien movies again from a slightly different angle, but not bringing anything new to it like Cameron did with the idea of, you know, the corporation.
Yeah, I was very disappointed with Prometheus, actually. I mean, it got very strong reviews, and to me, it had an interesting premise and then sort of devolved into this monster movie for the last half of it or last third of it. And that, you know, you never really figured out what the story was in terms of, you know, they awaken this ancient being, and then before you can communicate with it, he just starts attacking everybody.
Yeah, it just seemed like the last third of the movie was set up for another sequel, you know, which is par for the course these days, basically. You know, you could look at something. I mean, it's barely science fiction, but you know, the Dark Knight, you know, at least are trying to deal with issues, even if it's very much on a superficial level. There was a little bit of the whole Occupy movement woven into the storyline of, you know, the Dark Knight Rises, but you couldn't say that the movie really took a coherent point of view on it one way or another. It was just sort of window dressing.
Well, you did mention a few films earlier, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich, dealing with memories. And there's also another film that came out in the late 90s, one of my favorite movies, called Dark City, that you did mention in your book.
Right.
With Kiefer Sutherland and Rufus Sewell?
I think Rufus. Yeah,
Rufus Sewell, I think, is the protagonist who sort of, the audience is as much of the dark as the main character, essentially. He's waking up. He wakes up in a bathtub with no memory of who he is. But he just has, I guess, sorts of these fragments that slowly come back to him. And it's a movie that involves his self-exploration, trying to figure out exactly where he is. He's being hunted by the cops for a murder that he has no knowledge of. And very interesting movie. And, you know, you mentioned in your book, it's Roger Ebert loved it so much that he actually gave it a commentary on the DVD release.
Yeah, that's right. Although that's another movie that was kind of overlooked. It came out fairly close in time to The Matrix, and The Matrix was obviously a much more action-oriented, bigger spectacle than Dark City. But they did, have similar ideas of this protagonist with this past he doesn't really know, and a destiny of sorts, and a strange dystopian world. But Dark City, I was probably the more interesting. It's just one of a kind visually, for one thing.
I'm talking to Scott Van Duviak, who is the author of If You Like the Terminator, and it's a book full of recommendations in terms of not only film, but also video games as well, too, that sort of stem from the movie The Terminator, the iconic 84 action movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, directed by James Cameron, that was incredibly influential, not only in terms of science fiction cinema, but also looks at dystopian scenarios, looks at artificial intelligence. You know, we hadn't mentioned it before, but Battlestar Galactica, the reimagining of Battlestar Galactica that was on the Sci-Fi Network, that featured sort of a similar scenario in that you have this sort of alternate universe where the robots that were built to be laborers, built to be slaves, essentially, they become smart and self-aware and wage a war, and then they come back years and years later more evolved and advanced, and you actually now have robots that look like people, and it's very, very difficult to tell who's who. What were your thoughts on Battlestar Galactica?
Well, it was one of my favorite shows in the last 5-10 years or whatever it's been. You know, of course, it's based on a show that was on briefly when I was a kid and I watched it then, and that show is just kind of a dumb Star Wars ripoff. But the reimagined Battlestar Galactica is very interesting because there's this conflict between the humans and the Cylons, the cybernetic people. But as the series progresses, it becomes the differences become less and less. And towards the end, there's really no difference. They both become part of the DNA of what humans are today, basically. So it's sort of it's interesting in the way it finds a different path through the conflict of humans and machines, not to the destruction of one or the other necessarily, but some sort of common ground in between.
You mentioned The Hidden before, which is a film that I had not heard about before I read your book. What are some of the other, some of your favorites that the audience may not be aware of?
Well, as far as sci-fi that people may not be aware of, there's a low-budget time travel movie called Primer, and that is entirely there's no real special effects at all. The story is very, very difficult to follow. You really have to probably see it twice, but it's so interesting. It's just this takes time travel to this level of overlapping timelines, and the dialogue and the characters are just sort of these, they don't have a lot of personality, but it's just very fascinating to watch how the whole thing unfolds and to try and figure out what exactly is going on.
I enjoyed Primer a great deal, by the way, and made for $8,000, which is amazing. How about any other films besides Primer in the last decade?
I mentioned Scanner Darkly briefly, but that's one of my favorites, too. It's Richard Linklater. He's an indie filmmaker. He did Slacker and Dazed and Confused. He lives here in Austin and made this movie here in Austin, and it's based on a Philip K. Dick novel. It's got, fairly big stars in it. It's got Keanu Reeves and Robert Downey Jr. and Woody Harrelson, but it's done sort of with this rotoscoping type technology. It's a computer-animated technology where the sheet scenes were shot on video initially and then overlaid with this with animation. It's just one of those messing with your mind kind of movies where the hero, again, and Keanu Reeves has played this part several times now, is sort of the anti-hero of a futuristic world, semi-futuristic world, where he doesn't really know his true identity. He's a cop, but he's also the guy that he's investigating under a different identity. And there's some strange drugs going around, and there's a strange suit that's called the scramble suit that it's worth seeing.
You mentioned some of the classic Outer Limits episodes too, that in your book,
right? Depending on who you ask, they're either influences or they were completely plagiarized. If you ask Carlin Ellison, who is a famous science fiction writer who wrote a couple of these Outer Limits episodes, he believes that the Terminator is completely plagiarized from two of his episodes that have similar jumping-off points. In fact, one of them, the first 5 minutes of it, does look very much like the beginning of the Terminator, in which these two soldiers are fighting in a future decimated post-apocalyptic society. It looks a lot like the one in the Terminator, and then one of them gets sent back through time and arrives in an alley, you know, much like in the Terminator. But from that point on, it's a different story, really. And Cameron might have mouthed off once or twice about how, oh, I'm just ripping off these Outer Limits stories, sort of in jest, but Harlan Ellison didn't take it that way. He's a very litigious guy, and so he sued, and now all copies of the Terminator have a card at the end that reads, you know, with acknowledgement to the works of Harlan Ellison.
You go through it a little bit in your book and sort of dissect those episodes. And I mean, filmmakers are always borrowing from other filmmakers or from stories. And, you know, Quentin Tarantino, I mean, people have talked about it's been his whole career, right?
Exactly. And these are all pretty tried and true science fiction concepts. I mean, Harlan Ellison wasn't really reinventing the wheel, but he thinks he was.
Scott, have you read the Running Man story, the Stephen King story?
Yes. Yes, I have.
It was written under the name Richard Bachman. It came out in the early 80s. It's a 100-page novella. The Running Man, you did feature in your book, as in the Schwarzenegger chapter, looking at other Schwarzenegger sci-fi action movies of the 80s, also featuring this dystopian kind of Orwellian society, and where Schwarzenegger has to go on this lethal game show and win his freedom. But if, you know, the actual story that it was based on, it was completely different. And you know, the Running Man race didn't just run a gauntlet. You actually raced across the country. The main character was this sort of poor guy, this everyman, as opposed to a guy like Schwarzenegger.
Well, that happens a lot. You know, I actually read that story before the movie, and when I first saw the movie, I really hated it. When I rewatched it again for this, I just thought, well, it's just goofy fun. I mean, it's a total comic book. I mean, it's set in this future world, but Richard Dawson is still host of the game show, and there's all these characters that are straight out of comic books, Jesse Ventura and like that. But, you know, this happens a lot with Arnold, where you are supposed to have an everyman character, but they need a bankable star, and they put him in it. And one example of that is Total Recall, which is another based on a Philip K. Dick and just recently remade. And, again, it's a fun movie. It's kind of wild and crazy, but it doesn't really have anything to do. The story doesn't hold together because you just can't believe that Arnold Schwarzenegger is some everyman and he's gotten himself into this circumstance. So when it's revealed that he's not, he's actually this, you know, super spy. Of course he is.
I'm talking to Scott Von Doviak, who is the author of If You Like the Terminator, here are over 200 movies, TV shows, and other oddities that you will love. And looking at the Terminator as the hub of a number of different genres of cinema involving science fiction, artificial intelligence, dystopian futures. Anything else also that you're working on?
Well, talking to Stephen King, I just signed a deal with the same publisher, not the same series, but I'm going to be doing a massive retrospective of all his film and television stuff. So I'll probably be revisiting The Running Man yet again for that.
You know, you mentioned Stephen King, and I believe, isn't HBO doing a Dark Tower series?
Well, it's gone back. It's another one that's been in development for a long time, and it's gone back and forth. They were going to do movies, and then they were going to do sort of some kind of hybrid where there'd be movies in the theater plus an ongoing series on TV that would somehow tie into it. Last I heard, like, the whole idea had gotten, you know, really too expensive, so I'm not sure if that's going to happen or not. But they're doing HBO is doing a series of Under the Dome, which is not an open-ended story necessarily, but I guess that's what it's going to become on television.
Okay, I'm not familiar with Under the Dome.
Under the Dome is one of the more recent Stephen King novels. It's about sort of a small town in Maine, if you can believe that, but aliens put a dome over the top of it, for reasons we don't know, and nobody can get out, and nobody can get in, and it's all about how, you know, civilization decays from that point when they're trapped inside.
I've been talking to Scott Von Doviak, and again, he's the author of the recent book, If You Like the Terminator. Here are over 200 movies, TV shows, and other oddities that you will love. And thanks so much, Scott. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me on.